So, full disclosure, Ian already sat down for an interview with me about a week ago, correct? But those files got corrupted on my Mac for whatever reason. So, Ian here was gracious enough to sit down with me one more time. So, thank you, Ian. Thanks for being gracious.
And yeah, no problem, man. Sometimes there's just a glitch in the matrix.
Yeah, you said you're also not too technologically savvy, huh?
No, not at all, but I am persistent, so eventually I usually figure it out.
Awesome. Yeah, so not only is Ian a kick-ass vocalist, he's also a punk rock hero today. And tell me, Ian, what do punk rock heroes never do?
They never die, man.
That's my crappy little segue. I want to ask you, I want to rattle off a couple of lyrics for you. Just lyrics that I really liked off of The Lost Art of Empathy, your latest album. And I'd like it if maybe you could just give me a few words about either what they mean to you or what the context was when you wrote them. Just a little bit about each of those lyrics and maybe shed a little light on some of the central themes of the album. Does that sound cool for you?
Yeah, for sure. Let's do it.
All right. So the first one I have is... it's off the opener, Rust Belt, and it's, no one looked out for us, just sitting here waiting for the 56 bus, is that correct?
Yep.
No one's looked out for us, just sitting here waiting for the 56 bus. Now, I like that lyric in particular because it seems like you were intent on localizing yourself in a way that's very, you know, if you're in the know, then that's gotta feel sort of good to hear a punk rock vocalist speaking directly to you. So could you tell me a little bit about that? What is the 56 bus? Why the 56 bus?
Well, I live in Chicago, and I live on a street called Milwaukee Avenue, and that's actually my bus.
Awesome. That's one of the things I think is really like charismatic about the album, actually. Just a lot of the lyrics, I mean, people sort of blanket term the lyrics as like socio-political or whatnot, but I think they're very interpersonal. You know, I think you did a really great job of interspersing that that personability into your lyrics this time around. In particular, there's a lot of like odes to your hometown, and some of it's tongue in cheek, right. But there's always like an affection there. You know, and I really like that about them.
Yeah, because it's really funny you pick that lyric out because Rust Belt is kind of about my hometown. My first 21 years were in Cleveland, Ohio. And, you know, I was raised in the 80s, came of age in the 90s, so I saw a lot of the aftermath of all the factories closing and everything like that. You know, that area got hit pretty bad with the Rust Belt. So it's really funny you picked the one lyric that's about my time in Chicago.
Awesome. It just stood out to me for whatever reason.
It should be personal. I mean, I think politics is a very personal thing, and, you know, I always... have adhered to the rule that you know every political thing like really starts with yourself. You know, start every revolution with yourself, then think about your street, your neighborhood, and then move beyond. You know,
right?
It all starts locally, and what's more local than yourself? So I do think that it is very personal, at least for me.
No, I'd say that's a very astute observation. I think that sort of ties into the next lyric, which is off of Unity. You write, "What if punk rock becomes what I always thought it could be?" To me, that's you saying that, on a personal level and on a smaller level, you're able to sort of influence the scene, in a DIY way. And how has that helped you? What does that mean to you exactly? What if punk rock becomes what I always thought it could be?
I think it's kind of me trying to be a little funny, tongue-in-cheek, and also talking shit. I have always been more influenced by the more political side of punk rock, and that's one of the things that really drew me to it, and also what drew me to politics to begin with as well. And I don't know, around the time I moved to Chicago, I kind of was a little disheartened with the punk scene. I wasn't listening to any new bands. I was only listening to the older stuff. And it took, you know, there was probably 2-3 years, especially when I was in music college, where I wasn't listening to a whole lot of punk rock because I didn't really hear anything new being said.
Right.
And I think that was in the early 2000s to mid-2000s, so, I mean, you're getting the big Blink-182 influence and stuff like that. And it wasn't the type of music that I thought of as punk rock that was being called punk rock. So I think it was kind of
Just ideologically, not even.
Yeah, like I always thought being punk was synonymous with being political. Like it was about going against the grain, speaking your mind, and all those things. And then all this pop music comes out, and they're just talking about girls and cars and everything. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a time and place for everything. But
right.
Yeah, I think it was that lyric in particular was kind of like a little tongue in cheek way for me to poke fun at, you know, a scene that now that we got Trump in office, everybody's kind of clamoring to be political, and it's like, I was here the whole time. Come on, let's do this.
Right. I think we spoke about that last time, actually, about how Trump being in office, and just, I mean, all the crazy stuff that's happening in politics, I think it's, I mean, it's awful, but it's also good in a sense that it seems to be mobilizing people, and that seems to be really feeding a lot of the art lately, and I feel like maybe there is a resurgence in punk rock bands that have things to say that aren't, as you say, about, you know, cars and girls. That was more of like a hair metal thing, I feel, you know, not a punk rock thing. But I also
feel like bands that have been around for a while that necessarily never really were political and kind of stuck more towards the party side of life are starting to come out with more political songs now too, like bands that you wouldn't even think of. So yeah, it definitely influences each other. And this album, all the songs were written before Trump was elected, but it was while he was campaigning, and then they were all recorded well after he got elected. So I mean, right, it definitely had influence, but it wasn't a direct influence. It kind of was like at the same time these things were happening, me writing these as well as him coming to power.
Right.
But you might as well, listening to this album in hindsight, think that I wrote it after this whole thing, you know? It rings a little truer than I kind of meant it to at the time.
Well, I mean, even before the election, there was like a tangible kind of smog in the air. There was a fear, you know? And I think that even if you did write the lyrics prior to the actual election day, it was inescapable, you know? Like, you probably felt what everybody did. I mean, just kind of fear and not knowing what was gonna happen within the next coming months. Did you feel like your vocal performance was probably influenced by the outcome of the election? Like the performance itself, did it feel angrier as you were spouting off the lyrics, or was there a little bit of that?
It's a little bit angrier of an album for sure. And I mean, when the campaign was happening, everybody kept saying there's no way in hell that Trump can win. But I mean, we did 160 shows in 2016. 2 weeks of that was in Canada, and they knew way more about the election than we do.
Right.
And you know, I saw way more Trump signs and yards throughout the country, and it wasn't just in the South. New Jersey had some of the most we saw the whole time. So I definitely saw the writing on the wall, and you know, with Brexit the year before, and
right,
other things like this wave of I can't even quite call it conservatism. It's just crazy.
So it was
already happening. So I mean, the writing was on the wall. I didn't really believe it would happen, but I was still surprised when he got elected.
Right.
But I feel like I felt it had more of a chance than most.
Well, I remember reading the newspaper quite a bit around the around like mid October to early November, and I just remember thinking how quickly the polls would alternate on a day-to-day basis. They were getting different readings, and it just seemed so so much like guesswork at that point that I couldn't really say one way or another whether or not it was going to be impossibility for Trump to win. You know, I don't know.
Pollsters really messed it up on this, and they got a lot of flack for that. A lot of people.
Oh yeah,
but with everything that's happening are things that have never happened before. So I mean, how are we supposed to predict what's going to happen next when everything that happens day to day
is completely unprecedented?
I just saw I think it was USA Today put out a thing where since Trump's been in office, he's had 5.5 blatant lies every single day on average.
Oh wow.
Like totally provable. And that's just crazy that we can let somebody in that kind of office just view that and be held accountable. I mean, look what just happened in Alabama with that race. I mean, it was basically like, it was 8 women, I believe, or 9, that came out sexual harassment against Roy Moore.
Right,
it was
right.
Like, do we want this or a Democrat? Like, that was the national conversation. That's just messed up. And I know it's Alabama, but come on. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean,
it's crazy that was the national conversation. And obviously, that is very big change in pace of things since, you know, that happened. I mean, that's really changing the momentum, I feel like. But then again, that neutrality still went through. So, I mean, it's just kind of our new reality. They're going to keep throwing everything at the wall at once and see what sticks. They're going to push everything through they can while they can, because they're going to lose it in the midterms, and they know it.
It seems like it's more important to be against something than it is to be for something these days. I feel like a lot of nuance is dead. There's a lot of moral absolutism in the in the mainstream media, and I feel like a lot of your lyrics seem to nod at that. There's a couple of lines. I think most prominently on Alcorn Queen, you write, "Your perfect box is broken at the seams. One size fits all couldn't hold humanity."
Okay.
One size fits all couldn't hold humanity. What did that mean to you?
Well, that song is based off of, this is kind of a darker subject for us, but it was actually based off a suicide note from a high school trans student.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, you got the whole bullying aspect and everything like that, and, you know, I don't know. So that everything in that song was words that were in that suicide note.
Interesting. I didn't know that at all, actually. I thought it was tied into more so the general theme, like the not every issue is black or white, keep on twisting the public's will. I thought it was more along the lines of that sort of thing. But no, very interesting. I didn't know that at all.
Well, that's kind of something I like to do with lyrics is I like to have them to the point, but also vague enough that you can interpret them in your own way. It's kind of like the advantage of reading a book rather than the movie that's based off the book.
Right,
because your imagination comes into play and you use your own experiences to make that horror novel that much scarier or whatever. So I've always kind of done that where I want people to interject their own personal things into what I'm doing. I'm just trying to throw these things out on the table and have people start talking about them. I'm not trying to tell anybody to think this way or that way.
Right. Fill in your own blanks. I'm going to shift gears a little bit. I want to ask about a couple of song titles, actually. Really fun one, Dead by Dawn. Evil Dead 2 reference, right? Objectively, in my opinion, the best of the trilogy. I love the new show as well with Bruce Campbell, the Ash versus the Evil Dead. I think it's fantastically cheesy.
I just started watching that.
Isn't it so cool?
I'm a big fan of all those, obviously. And I would agree with you. Evil Dead 2 is probably my favorite, but I love them all.
Yeah, I love that Bruce Campbell knows what his niche is. He's totally just the quintessential B movie star.
Yes, he's the best. I love him.
No, I thought that was a cool reference to throw in. I had to ask you about that one. Another song title. So there isn't a title track on the album, but there is a title line. In fact, the name of the album is capitalized in the line on Corporate Pariah. Could you tell me, I know you had a little anecdote about that and how the Lost Art of Empathy came to be the album title, and I know you had kind of kicked around whether or not Corporate Pariah sort of fit the central themes of the album or not. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we were trying to think of the name for the album. We actually held an online contest, and in that I specifically said not any of the song names. I don't have a problem with that. There just wasn't necessarily a song in this album that I felt like stood out from the rest. I kind of felt like it was more of a package deal.
Right.
So, overwhelmingly, out of like 700 responses in the contest, my favorite name was Lost Art of Empathy, which is actually the name of the song we're talking about, Corporate Pariah, initially. So, when I decided that I wasn't going to do better, that name just like fit perfectly with everything that was it was very topical and political and like my viewpoint of the current world, it just fit in so well. But at the same time, that song's kind of a little bit different than a lot of the other songs on here. It's got a little ska breakdown.
Right,
and
right.
Other things. So I didn't feel like it should be the title track. So I just changed the name of the song so I could name the album.
Gotcha.
What it comes down to, because I just felt like it just was perfectly
it
encapsulated everything that I was trying to say with all these songs. You know, it was a very good summary to the point.
Yeah. Absolutely. I agree. It completely encapsulates, I think, all the themes that I sort of found important on the album, or the ones that stuck with me anyway. You mentioned that ska breakdown. That's interesting. I hear like a ton of influences throughout the Lost Art of Empathy. I hear like you said, the ska, the post hardcore. I hear even some riffs have like a metallic edge to them, like a East Coast hardcore sort of vibe to them. I want to know, you had said there was a time that you weren't really listening to a ton of new punk bands. What were you listening to around that time? And do you think that some of those influences shine through in your music now? Do you feel that you made more of a conscious effort to weave a more grand fabric for this album than in prior albums? I just feel like you've got such a huge tapestry of sounds on this, while never quite deviating completely from the whole punk template, there is a lot to chew on this album in terms of sonics, you know, and aesthetics. So could you tell me a little bit about sort of your influences and maybe an influence that people might not know of yours?
Right.
So, I don't believe in guilty pleasure, so I'm not going to call it a guilty pleasure, but, you know, just something, yeah.
Yeah, so when I first moved to Chicago, it was initially for music college. I went to Columbia. So one of my majors was instrumental performance, and when you do that, they basically, you have to learn every single style that there is. So you just become immersed in everything. So that kind of was just, I was busy as hell during that time and wasn't digging deep enough is really what it was. There definitely was good new stuff happening in punk rock. I just didn't have my finger on the pulse, I feel like, you know?
Right.
What I heard on the surface wasn't doing it for me. I just didn't have the resources to dig deeper. So I always describe our sound as kind of my classical training mixed with ADHD equals BOA. Because I have a very unique songwriting process, and I always try to change it up. There's four songs, maybe five songs on this that don't even have a chorus.
Right.
I don't, which is really odd and weird, and something I've been experimenting with lately. And I like to do all that. So yes, I always like to stick with the energy and the emotion that, you know, most people think of when they think of the punk rock genre. But I really hate the stigma of punk rock, and as far as musicianship and skill level.
Right.
So I love breaking that mold and like showing beyond. Like, I'm a big fan of Propaganda and Descendants, and those are some great musicians that, you know, are in the punk rock genre. And so I always like to throw stuff like that in there to, one, keep it interesting, because I got to play these songs every night.
Right.
And I'm just hoping everybody else feels the same way. So, I mean, I'm writing music for myself at the end of the day, but yes, I mean, I definitely do like the genre hop, and I like to keep things interesting, and I'm always trying to employ new techniques and keep it interesting. But at the same time, I like to have one part in every song where somebody can, like, kind of sing along with you, even if they've never heard the song before when you're playing live.
Just something to latch on to.
Yeah, so having a little anthemic element as well as with the progressive instrumental stuff. Like, those two things I always try to incorporate in almost every song.
I can totally see that. You said that you made a conscious decision to not include choruses on four songs on the album, you said?
Yes.
What do you build... Where do you build from when you're writing a song like that? Not to pull the curtain back too far, but when you're writing a song like that, where do you branch out from? What do you start with?
Okay, so we were just talking about Dead by Dawn. So that's a pretty good one. There's an intro, there's an outro, and then there's a middle part. And what the middle part is actually a three-part voice canon. So you ever, like, sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat and have the other person start, like, halfway through the line?
Yeah.
You know? So it's just like doing a canon like that, and that's what the song is. It's a three-part vocal canon where we all come together on the last line, and that's it. That's
yep.
The entire vocal part of the song. There's no chorus, which seems... And it's not even, like, I intentionally go out to do this. Sometimes it just, like, happens. I'm a big believer that when the inspiration hits, you just roll with it. I always keep a little pad, paper, and pen with me at all times. I have forever, because you never know what's going to hit you and what's going to inspire you. It could be... lyrical line, a melody, a rhythm, anything can hit you. And, you know, sometimes I write an entire song, 15 minutes, and everything's done and perfect, exactly how I want it. Other times, riff, fester for 6 months to a year before you find the right things to glue them together. You never know what's going to fit, and I always try to keep open to that. In rehearsals, I always say, you know, there's no such thing as a dumb idea. We will try every idea once, no matter how stupid it is. And then after we play it once, we can say that was very stupid. We'll never do that again. But I'm a big believer in that. You never know what's going to work, and you just got to keep your ears open and keep trying and keep experimenting. Keep, you know, like you said, your perfect box. You know, you just got to kind of bust out of that box. One of my favorite quotes I got in college was, "You got to learn the rules before you know how to break them." And I always like that about, you know, going to a classically trained school is, I don't know, because you just want to stop learning that stuff and just go out there and play your heavy music, you know,
right,
you don't
right.
want to, like, listen to them. But there was something to that that's always stuck with me, and I don't know, I think it's important to learn what's come before you so you know what's possible in the future.
So, I mean, you tend not to junk any riffs. Do you find that everything has sort of a baking temperature where at some point you might have something, so you never completely trash a section?
Yeah, true. You never know what's going to work. You never know what's gonna fit. But there have been plenty of times when I thought I had the song completely right, and then I completely forgot a transition part that made it all
right.
work. And then you have to rewrite the whole second half of the song. I mean, there's probably a couple songs on this album that happened with where, you know, maybe they got shelved for a month or two for other reasons, and we just couldn't quite remember them the same way. So I'm trying to be better with that, recording more scratches and demos to streamline the process better, because everybody's busy. It gets hard to keep things moving, and it's really hard to stay relevant, keep providing content, which is why we're so excited to finally get another full-length out there. We had some member changes, so our last full-length was all the way back in 2011.
Right, right.
So we were far overdue.
So you're working on a DVD next year, correct? A documentary?
Yeah, that's all done. It's going to be in a bunch of festivals the first 6 months of the year. So I don't know exactly when.
Oh, you're releasing it in 2018, but everything's all set to go with that?
Yeah. So the very end of 2016, we were followed around for 4.5 weeks on a West Coast tour with. From Madness Maker Films, and the documentary is going to be called Punk Band. It's a full-length feature film that followed us around for that tour. And I'm not sure exactly when it'll be available to the public outside of these festivals, but I'm imagining by the summer, probably.
Right. That, I mean, that sounds really cool. That's you said you were just in touring around America and just getting to visit different cities and whatnot. I know you book shows at home with your Wrecking Ball Productions, is that correct?
Yeah.
I think that's such a cool way to keep a scene fresh and to help it flourish is to... Like, I remember when I was a kid and there were, you know, especially growing up in New York, you'd walk by like a warehouse and you go, yo, how cool would it be to put a show on in there, you know? And then eventually that idea turned into a tangibility and you go, who do I have to speak to get bands to play in there, and eventually you find yourself a door guy, get some bright wristbands, and you got yourself an all ages show. And I always really loved that about local punk scenes and local metal scenes. How do you feel that you've been able to sort of keep the influence going on the Chicago punk scene, and do you feel that there are other cities that have a burgeoning punk scene that people might not know about? How are things being kept fresh on that front? Because I find in New York in particular, there's a huge niche for metal. We've got like niche venues and I mean like festivals, makeshift venues. I don't see a lot of that for punk. I see a lot of like big brand stuff like the like Punk Island. Not so much DIY stuff in the same way that you're picking homegrown bands and putting them on and really building the thing up from the inside out, you know. So how have you been able to sort of cultivate your own scene?
Well, I actually think New York and Chicago are pseudo similar. They both have great punk scenes, but there's also a ton of people putting on these shows, especially the bigger ones. So I tend to book the bands that are really freaking good that have a problem, you know, with getting in with the politics and whatnot in the decent venues here. You know,
yeah, that's super important.
So that's who I'm trying to help out. And, you know, when you see a younger band or a newer band with tons of talent, hell yeah, let's keep booking them on as the opener until they can grow a fan base, and then, you know, they can start headlining their own shows. You know, that's the whole thing. It's really hard because the average life of a punk band is like 2 days.
It's like a fruit fly.
Yeah, I'm an anomaly with this, man. I just can't quit it for some reason. But you got to invest in your own, and you got to also bring the bands through, because people aren't going to keep coming out to see the same local bands. So you got to keep it interesting with bringing people through, and that's right. Cool, because with touring, I get to meet so many good bands from around the country, and, you know...
You ever bring any of those bands with, like any of the bands that you start booking with the Wrecking Ball Productions? You ever start seeing them grow a fan base locally and decide to take them on out with you?
Not personally. I tend to not like touring with other bands. It makes it a lot harder. It's a lot easier on your own. But yeah, plenty of bands have grown their own thing and gone off and done their own tours and everything else. I mean, there's only so much you can play local. I'm sorry, you know.
No, I hear that.
There's a lot of bands who don't tour and they just keep playing too much and too much local. And, you know, it's important to keep hitting different markets. So as far as good scenes, I really like, I mean, you can't deny Chicago's punk scene. Again, you can't deny New York's punk scene. You got two markets in California, both in SoCal and San Francisco, that are great. Portland's got a great punk scene out there, too. Seattle's is great. I like all of those. On the East Coast, Richmond's really good for some weird reason. In Virginia, Atlanta's pretty good. St. Petersburg, Florida's pretty good. Austin, Texas is good. Dallas, Texas is good. Those are probably the best. Until I like Canada, too. Montreal and Toronto are great.
Basically all the cities, huh?
Detroit's great. Yeah, but the thing is, it's a big country, man. There's a lot of places in between, and there's a lot of one-horse towns I played at some point, or college towns, and those can be great, too. I mean, there's no real recipe for what makes a great show. Sometimes you play in a small town where they don't really get a lot of stuff, everybody comes out. And then when you play in a bigger market like Chicago or New York, there's so many different things going on every night that it's harder to get people out because of the competition. So you're always weighing those two things.
I was going to ask, what can you think of, either from your last tour or maybe just sometime last year, what's like the most patently punk venue that you've played? Anything weird, like you play a barn or like a church basement? Anything stick out in your memory?
Man, you end up playing everything at some point. We played the Southern Georgia show that was definitely a redone barn into a... It's really funny because somehow this random show from 2006 came up in an interview a couple weeks ago, because this dude, I started this band with a friend of mine, Jeff, that I grew up with, and he was still in the band at this point. And this dude was there, and he claimed he went to school with us growing up, and neither of us could remember him. And he kept trying to get us to come back to his place.
Oh, poor guy.
And sleep in his horse stables. And I'm like, I pull him aside, I'm like, we're going to get murdered if we go there, dude. We're not going there. So we didn't. But it's really funny that
sounds like the complete opposite of a good time, by the way. Like, none of that sounds like a good pitch.
It's been a while. New York still have the Lit Lounge?
Yes, actually.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you play there in the basement, it's literally a dungeon.
There's a couple places like that. Europa kind of feels like that, too. I don't know if you know Club Europa, but they have, like, the nice club upstairs, and then you go downstairs and it's so seedy, and like you don't even get to go in the main entrance if you're a band like Loading In. They make you go into the, like, the side like dirty entrance into the dive bar. But I actually, you know, I love shows like that. I really do. Just like finding little holes in the wall to kind of set up shop in and play. I think that's really cool and really important for a thriving punk scene.
As fun as it is to play on, like, enormous stages with great sound, you know, the DIY thing of, like, no barriers, you know, the stage is either the same height or barely more than that, you know, so you're, like, on the same level as the audience, it also, like, kind of brings on audience participation, you know, pick gang vocals on the choruses.
Right, right.
More people moving around, more people doing everything. Like, I mean, yeah, I feel like there's way more energy when there isn't that big division.
It's a complete
stage and audience.
Complete difference in intimacy. I mean, I think intimacy is so important for to put on a good show, man. Like, I love that there's no divide between bands like yours and the fans, you know what I mean? I love the interactivity, and you're right, you don't get that with festivals, you don't get that with big main stages like a Hammerstein Ballroom. The best shows are always, like you said, where the stage is just 2 inches above the floor, just something to look at the band, and I don't know, I've always found that aesthetic kind of charming, you know, and
people just don't move around as much on those shows, and I mean, that's part of the punk rock thing. You want people to move around. You don't necessarily need to beat each other up, but, you know, just dance, have a good time. I mean, have you
get some energy going.
Show, have you been to a big show lately? I'm decently tall. I'm 6'2", and still, it's everybody and their brother is just holding up their smartphones, taking video of the band rather than watching it.
How annoying is that?
At like some bigger festivals I was at later this summer, I saw people doing the smartphone thing, but they weren't even taking it of the stage. They were taking it of the big screen next to the stage, and I'm like, what is wrong?
That's like extremely meta. That's like 5 degrees of separation from the actual band you could be watching.
Right, and then you have the audience just standing there with their arms crossed. And also, there's nothing I hate more than watching a band that just stands there and plays their songs. It's like, why wouldn't I just listen to your album? I mean, you do need to be a showman. It is a performance. You know what I mean? You do have to do more than that. I'm not saying you got to go all out like Gwar and have all the whole shtick, but you got to move around. You got to include the audience in the show. They're an element, you know, and that's something that's missed once you get to these bigger shows.
I feel like a lot of punk bands from the 80s. I mean, sure, you had like Iron Maiden with Eddie and, like you said, Gwar, but as far as just a band putting on a performance, no smoke and mirrors, no, you know, no magic tricks. I think bands like the Bad Brains really encapsulated that sort of audience connection with their energy. It's something you didn't really get until bands like that who really knew how to put on a show. So I'm glad you said that, like, putting on a performance is an important aspect of what you do. Do you feel like that's something that's going by the wayside now? Do you not see a lot of bands that are putting forth that extra bit of effort to sort of make themselves stand out from the crowd? I don't necessarily feel that way, but I don't see a lot of bands that really wow me in that sense anymore. You know, it just doesn't happen nearly as often.
I feel like for the genre, you have to if you want to stand out. There's just too many bands. Like,
oversaturation?
Yes, oversaturation in the marketplace, man. I say it all the time. I mean, you can go and get a guitar for $50, spend like $100-$200 on some Pro Tools and record a demo in, you know, your parents' basement. I mean, anybody can put out music now. So there's so much music out there, which is great because you can reach so many people, but it's harder than ever to stand out. So it's really messed up because it's easier than ever to get out there into the world, but it's harder than ever to get people to listen to you. So, I mean, if you're trying to get to the next level, especially as a punk band, you got to do it, or nobody's going to notice you. You're not going to stand out, and people are going to not keep coming to your shows. So I do feel like a lot of people do it, but it's, again, once you get to that area when, you know, you got the elevated stage, the bright lights on you, when those are on you, you can't see anything in front of you. You don't know anybody's out there. And I still enjoy that, and we do that plenty, but there's something about that energy of a smaller show when you can interact with people and just go out there and dance with them in the middle of a song, you know?
Yeah. So when you're looking for new band members, because you said you've gone through some lineup changes, is that part of what you're looking for in a new bandmate, or is that something that maybe you have to impart on them most of the time?
It's cultivated, to be honest. It's really hard for people to... like I said, I just can't quit this thing.
Right.
So, to find people that are able to tour like I want to, usually I have to go with people that are a little bit younger and have the ability to do so. It's usually people, you know, fresh out of college or something like that. So usually they don't have a ton of touring experience, so you got to kind of, like, work them up to that.
Well, luckily, I mean, that means you can teach them new tricks. They're not set in their ways as of yet.
Right, and I mean, a drummer, yeah, they have so much going on already, they can get away with just playing drums. But, you know, if you're standing up playing guitar, you gotta do more than just stand there, you know?
Right.
I won't let that happen, man. I'll start headbutting them in the middle of the song, moving around, man.
That's totally what I wanted to hear, actually. I love the idea of you, the older one in the band, sort of hyping up the young guys and making them be all they could be, you know?
Yeah, man, you gotta get pumped, man, because I was always told, you know, you gotta play every show the same no matter who's out there, because when you're touring, you're playing Mondays and Tuesdays, and they aren't all going to be in the bigger cities. I mean, there's a lot of area in this country and some big, long drives, So you end up playing Mondays and Tuesdays in, like, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and places like that that are just a lot smaller and only have so many bands.
Right.
And so much of a scene. So, I mean, I've always gone by the thing, like, you got to perform the same whether there's, you know, 10 people there or 300. You know, you got to give it your all every time because you never know who's going to be watching you.
Right.
So maybe, you know, it was a shit show on a Monday in a no-name town and only, like, 15 people came out, but, like, one of those people... you blew them away. It was like the show of the week. So next time you come through town, they've told all their friends.
Right.
And they come. I mean, that's how you build things, you know?
That's harder to do, right? Like, to appeal to a smaller audience. Because I feel like crowds as a monolithic thing are pretty, they understand what they like.
They give you energy.
Right.
As long as they're liking it.
But people can feed off one another in those larger crowds. When you've got, like, 15 people kind of scattered around the room, it's much harder to tell everybody to come up front to the stage and you know, do your thing with you. I think that's always been a lot tougher than appealing to, like, a large festival crowd. Do you find that happens a lot? I mean, do you get a lot of shows where there's, like, you know, 10 people that come out and you totally turn them by the end of the show?
Sometimes when you play those smaller shows, everybody's dancing the whole time. Other times, you know, this could be the same as a show with over 100 people there where everybody's just kind of back in the shadows with their arms crossed, not really moving.
Right.
Which, you know, if that's your thing, there's nothing wrong with that. But, I mean, as a performer, we like people moving because we can feed off that energy.
Of course.
You know, but yes, it gets hard no matter how big a show is if people aren't giving back the energy that you're throwing out there. It's hard to keep that going for the entire set, and that's something that, you know, you learn over time from doing this is, you know, it's kind of like eye on the prize. You just got to kind of fake it and pretend that they're giving you what you're not hearing, and I think every performer does that. I mean, even no matter what's going on, you got to pretend like it's a packed house and everybody's going crazy.
Right.
Because you never know who's going to be out there, and people have gotten discovered doing way crazier things. So...
All right, Ian, I'm not going to keep you on for too much longer. Do you have anything you want to plug for the upcoming year? Let us know what Voice of Addiction is going to be doing or what we can look forward to as an audience. What's 2018 looking like for Voice of Addiction and you in particular?
So we got the new lineup down, so I'm starting to book shows now. There's going to be a ton of Midwest and regional stuff going on, but the big tours are going to be May 10th through June 10th on the West Coast. We're also going to be making our first appearances in both Tijuana, Mexico and Vancouver, Canada on that tour. We've done like 8 Canadian tours, but never the West. And then in the end of September through most of October, we'll be doing our Canadian East Coast tours. So really excited for that. Looking forward to keep writing. So hopefully this time next year, we're back in the studio working on the next bowling.
That's incredible that you have you've got shows booked all the way up until September. Is that all you during your downtime?
There's no such thing as downtime, man.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that. Like, you're always on the go. You get home from tour, you start booking shows, you start planning for the year ahead. It's great. It's great that you've got so much fortuitiveness, you know, and. I guess that just comes with the stamina of, like you said, playing the exact same way every night. You know, it's just a cultivated sort of energy that you're bringing to the table. And I love that you've got all this stuff on the horizon and it's not even 2018 yet, man. That's really cool.
Well, as much as I love going in the studio and recording music, it's the live show that keeps me going. And it's that feeling I get, like, and I sing and play bass, so I get a little bit more of an outlet through that, I feel like. But the way I feel after performing on stage, and especially after a tour, it's super humbling, and it brings me back, like, to the ground and restores my faith in humanity, because with social media and the 24-hour news cycle, everything's a downer. But then you actually get out there and meet people, and people are great. You just don't really realize that from what we're showing through all these screens. So, I mean, that's what I do is for the live show. So I'm trying to push us out there live as much as is humanly possible while we can still do it, because I think that's the most important thing these days.